Hello, and welcome to Around It About Chattanooga. I am your host, Michael Edward Miller. We've got a very special episode today. We're devoting the entire show to a conversation with the editor of one of the largest news organizations in the country. We're going to talk about investigative journalism and an almost unbelievable story that he uncovered. We'll also talk about how his organization has become one of the biggest news websites in the country. Devon Maharaj is the editor of the Los Angeles Times Media Group. That group includes the Los Angeles Times newspaper and LATimes.com. He champions investigative reporting and watchdog journalism. I spoke with him yesterday. He visited the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga campus. He's actually an alumnus here at UTC, and he was making a presentation on campus. Here's our conversation. So you actually have a very strong connection to this city. You're in L.A. now, but you lived here in Chattanooga. You went to college here at UTC. And is it true you were the editor of the student newspaper, The Echo, here?
I probably served as editor, but I think my exact title was managing editor. A friend of mine, Khalid Matawa, who's now a professor at the University of Michigan, was the editor then.
So is that kind of what got you into journalism, being here at UTC, or were you interested before that?
Actually, that's a good question. I was a journalist before I came to UTC. I worked for 5 years at a very small paper called the Trinidad Express in the Southern Caribbean.
Oh, wow.
And so when I came here, I had 5 years' experience under my belt, and the communication classes were great, but I gravitated to rounding out my education with lots of classes in political science and history, too.
And I understand you actually met your wife here at UTC.
That's right. It's a very, you know, a cool romantic story about that. This young woman with, you know, sparkling green eyes, Abby Harris, and she was a former DJ at WUTC. She had a New Age program. I met her in a Faulkner class. She became my study mate and then my soulmate. She came out to California. We lived around the world, including Africa, and as I said, she's the best editor I've had.
And you're here with me today. We're actually here on the UTC campus inside the new TV studio. It's part of the Department of Communication. What exactly are you going to be doing today in the TV studio?
Actually, I came to see the cool new facilities, and I came to talk to a group, including some communications and poli-sci and writing students at noon. But it's great to see the university's commitment to storytelling, and storytelling at its finest. As we know, there's major convergence now in the business, and you just can't be a print reporter anymore or a broadcast reporter anymore. You have to be or a radio reporter anymore. You have to, you know, kind of merge these forms and be good at a lot of things to be able to be an effective storyteller. And the university investing in such great facilities is something to complement.
Being the editor of the LA Times, has that been a challenge for you, particularly with like the men and women who've been doing it for, you know, 20 or 30 years and they're kind of set in their ways, teaching them this new way of doing things?
Absolutely. I think it's a challenge not only at the LA Times but at every newsroom in the country, because what is happening now is the internet and the web, they're offering new forms of storytelling. Before, you could, you know, go work, when you worked for a newspaper, you could make several calls a day, and at the end of the day, you sit back, write the story, you know, turn it into an editor who would edit it, send it to a copy editor, then someone would send it to a slot, and, you know, wait for the paper in the morning. Well, that kind of appointment reading has changed.
Oh, yeah.
Some people still love the newspaper, but now with, you know, .coms and with web news, readers want it when they want it, and usually that's now. So the challenge is trying to get print journalists to adapt to the world of real-time news. And I think we've met the challenge at LATimes.com because our website has grown by leaps and bounds every year. We are now charging people, we call them members, to read online. If you get past like 10 stories a month, you'd have to start paying, and tens of thousands of readers are paying us for that. So, but it is a challenge and something that we are continuing to work on.
I'd like to talk to you about investigative journalism. You've strongly advocated that throughout your career. I want to go back to 1992 when you were a staff writer at the LA Times. You spent a year investigating a lawyer named James Gunderson, and I want to start out just reading an excerpt from one of your articles. I think this is just an amazing opening sentence for an article. An Orange County lawyer who boasts of representing more than 7,000 Leisure World retirees has prepared numerous wills, making himself the recipient of millions of dollars in cash, stock, and real estate, a year-long Times investigation has found. And so I want to get this setting straight here. So this is a huge retirement community. This lawyer is here, kind of like the house lawyer, drawing up wills for people, but somehow he's making himself the beneficiary?
That's right. He was on the ground floor, so to speak, when Leisure World, it was then a social experiment. It was a place where retirees from across the country came to Southern California, not far from the beach, not far from Laguna Beach, and they had tons of activities. He was the lawyer that started the appropriate practice right outside, literally outside the gates of Leisure World. This story started with a story I wrote about elderly abuse, and there were lots of people taking advantage of older folks. You know, they came from a generation that was very trusting of others. So if you said, you know, I'm going to charge you X amount for this service, and then they got paid Y, and they said, oh, because we had to do this extra work, they would pay it, but they were really being robbed. After I did a weekend front page story about elderly abuse, I thought to myself, I had picked up some tips, and I thought to myself, you know, I really need to drill down deeper and find the culprits who are really taking advantage of the Leisure World retirees. And I narrowed it down, and I saw that there was a certain pattern with some people. With Mr. Gunderson, there was a pattern where he was actually drawing up wills where some of his clients were actually, he had courts declared with severe dementia, and he was made the custodian of their financial accounts and their affairs, rather, and making health decisions and financial decisions for them. And he was drawing up their wills that left him and parties close to him as beneficiaries of their wealth. In some cases, he inherited millions of dollars in stock. In one case, he inherited a square mile of land, and his alma mater would receive money from his clients' estates when they died. It took me a while to put the story together, but after it was put together, legislator changed the law, proposed a bill which eventually passed in the California legislature to change the laws that governed how lawyers could behave in this manner.
I mean, that's just an amazing thing where you do a series of articles that literally changes the law, that inspires that kind of change. How did you convince your editors early on, you know, this is worth pursuing, this is something I need to spend a lot of time on, this could result in something seriously meaningful?
Well, at first I didn't convince them, so there's a story behind that. At first I was a police reporter, and I had, you know, police duties to do, which meant I had to call dozens of police agencies every day saying what's going on. So I had a full-time job, but what I did was at the end of the day I convinced a judge to let me in the courthouse to review the files, especially the dozens, maybe hundreds of files involving this attorney. And when I had enough evidence, I went to my editors and said, look, you know, we got to take this seriously now. And they said, wow, you know, go with it.
That's Devon Maharaj. He's the editor of the Los Angeles Times Media Group, and he's a UTC alumnus. We'll have more in a minute.
Funding comes from Enzo's Market, featuring fresh turkeys, chef-inspired trimmings, desserts, and holiday gift boxes. More information at enzosmarket.com.
Support comes from LifePoint Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine, celebrating National Acupuncture Day on October 24th with an open house in their new location, 3914 St. Elmo Avenue, second floor. Events will include a lunch hour community acupuncture with guided meditation and evening talks on acupuncture, Chinese herbs, and seasonal food. Online at lifepointaom.com.
You're listening to Around It About Chattanooga. I'm speaking with Devon Maharaj. He's the Los Angeles Times editor. We're talking about an investigative series he wrote in the 1990s about a probate attorney named James Gunderson. Gunderson drew up wills for elderly clients, some of them suffering from dementia. Gunderson drew up these wills where he personally would be a beneficiary, and he convinced some of his clients to sign them. He made millions of dollars doing that. This was in the 1990s in California, and such practices were technically not illegal in that particular place and time. My guest, Devon Maharaj, uncovered this and wrote about it in the LA Times. Maharaj went on to become the paper's editor.
And I understand at first, James Gunderson, the lawyer who was doing all this, was actually willing to talk to the paper about it and kind of defend himself.
That's right. I recall that very clearly today because, you know, I guess it was like 60 Minutes style. I went to him and said, I want to talk to you about, you know, about the probate practice, about your practice, your activities, without giving him, to be frank, a whole lot of information. And he said yes, and to be honest with you, I was as nervous as he was. And I went to the conversation. I said, do you accept gifts from your clients? He said, absolutely no.
No?
Yeah, absolutely no. Do you, if your clients give you a gift, what do you say? You said, no, I work. He said, no, I work for a fee. I do not want, I do not accept gifts. So I very gingerly, like I said, I was nervous, started pulling out files and said, do you remember Emerald Mary Sully? You know, that was a case where he inherited millions of dollars in AT&T stock, right? And he says, yes, she was someone who, and he described the case, and I'm like, I tried to correct the facts that, you know, were on the record in the courthouse. And after going through a couple of, he looked at me and said, this is a hatchet job, isn't it? Right? And it was the first time I saw someone. He was wearing a light blue shirt, and within a minute, maybe two at most, the entire thing was wet. And he excused himself from the room, and I said, oh, my God, something's going to happen to me now. So he came back, and he was far more composed, and he said, you know, can we continue this conversation tomorrow? And we had already set up a photo shoot at his house where he was a collector of exotic birds, and he had used some of his clients' money to buy these exotic birds. So we had already set up a photo shoot to go to his house and take pictures of this. And I said, oh, by the way, can we keep that appointment tomorrow?
I take it he said no.
He said yes, but then called back.
He said yes.
He called back, and next thing you know, there were fax machines back then. So he faxed the publisher, and I recall a lawyer starting like this, a letter starting like this, rather. It says, there, Mr. Publisher, you know, I've been a subscriber to the LA Times for 40 years. Never before have I had the opportunity to write, you know, complaining about something. I believe my office was broken into and some of my files were stolen. And those files are now in the possession of one of your reporters named Devon Maharaj, you know. So, of course, I was called by the editor and I've been going through the courthouse. All the records came from the courthouse, by the way.
Yeah, you were not breaking into anything to get
correct. But I said I can actually... give you 100% definitive answer that there was no breaking. At that time, I had the good fortune, being the police reporter, as I told you I was, I knew the captain who was in charge of that area of Orange County. So I called him up, gave him the address of the office, and I said, can you tell me if you have any record of a break-in at this office? you know, go back a year, go back 2 years. And so he called back and actually sent over a note that there's never been a record of a break-in at this office, which was good enough for me and good enough for the publisher, but, you know, not that they doubted it or anything like that.
And at the time, this lawyer who was inheriting millions of dollars from his own clients, this wasn't actually technically illegal in California, was it?
Technically, no. No rules really prevented him from doing so, even though morally and ethically, you know, the state bar and could probably cite California codes where it was not advisable, but it was illegal in a different way.
And then once these reports came out, it did become illegal.
Correct.
So that's really an example of how investigative journalism can change society.
Yes, and this is what I try to preach to my very, very talented writers, because this is what we do, you know. This is the kind of work that I think journalists exist to do, public service. At the heart of this kind of work is public service. It's writing wrong. It's writing wrongs and trying to make it a better place, make the cities, the country a better place, a better democracy. That's how our system works.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking to Devon Maharaj. He is the editor of the Los Angeles Times and a UTC alumnus. The LA Times, it's one of the top-ranked news websites in the United States. What do you think you're doing specifically that's bringing in readers from all around the country to read an LA newspaper online?
Well, covering the news in real time. We are good at it. We want to get even better at it. You know, when news breaks, we're still blessed to have 500-plus people in our newsroom, and many of them are the experts in our field. If it involves politics, entertainment, technology, you know, we are blessed to be in one of the most interesting cities, one of the most interesting states, I would argue, in the world, right, where you have Hollywood, you have Silicon Valley, you have a huge agriculture industry that very few people know about, and it's just plain interesting for geography and people. So and we have a big footprint. We have a robust foreign staff around the world, people who are now in war zones covering Syria and Afghanistan and, you know, the Middle East. We have a robust bureau in Washington covering, you know, the politics of the day. So first and foremost, you have to have an army like that to cover real-time news. But then you have to do the, you know, differentiated content, differentiated stories like the kinds we talked about.
Earlier this year, you were at UC Riverside, and you said, news on a website is not a perfect product. That's a pretty interesting statement. What do you mean by that?
Well, on some websites, it's not a perfect product because some clarification is needed. What you need to do is, what reporters are now doing is reporting things in chapters, right? Like I said before, in the old days, a print reporter would go and make 10, 15 calls, right, and then write the story.
Yeah.
Now you have to make one or two, write the story, and build on it, and write smaller chapters. At the end of the day, you have a bigger you have the full book, right? So if you look at just one event, one post, that post might not be, you know, perfect. It might be accurate, but the final one is the one that you want to, that's the book that you want readers to really make sure they read to get the fullest picture.
What do you think the future is of news, particularly print news on the web? And what I mean by that specifically is, for example, yesterday, the Senate and the House finally reached that budget deal yesterday to end the government compromise. And a lot of news websites, as soon as it broke, they would put up a post, as you were saying. And then a few minutes later, they'd get more information, so they'd put the word update at the top of the post and add more. And then more information and the word update. And pretty soon, you have something that goes on for like three pages with the word update over and over and over again. It just seems like a clunky, messy way to do it.
Yes, I think, you know, as we talked earlier, the web offers new forms of storytelling, right? And in a breaking story like that, you probably need to have something, you know, a live blog doing it, because readers want to see what's happening in real time. At the same time, you know, readers want you to tell them what this all means. Give me the background, give me the context, give me the analysis. And I think the future of news would be you know, those two things, which is breaking news, but it would be explained to me in real time. And the onus is on journalists like us to bring out the smart people, people who would have the knowledge, who may or may not have to do a lot of research, and say, this is what it means, and this is what you've got to look for, right? And, you know, this is why January or February, when those new deadlines were established yesterday, those months would be important for the Republicans, the White House. You know, the future really is in making sure that you have enough people with expertise who can bring meaning and context to the news.
That's interesting, particularly the word context, because I was thinking about that the other day. Before I got into journalism myself, if I read an article in the paper on a complicated economic subject and I just didn't understand it, I would think, oh, it's my failure as a reader for not getting it. But now I'm much more inclined, if I read an article and it doesn't make sense to me, to think it's a failure of the journalist to write it in a way that makes sense to the average reader.
That's right, and that's why you notice that readers are searching for that context, especially when news is happening. So there's something. It's something very simple. Like the LA Times, we do a good job covering the Oscars, okay?
Oh, yeah.
But some readers, they simply want to know what time, you know, does the show begin? So guess what? You have to write a post on that. But for example, on a complicated economic topic, you'd have to say, you know, what does raising the debt limit really mean to you?
Right.
You know, and you have to answer that question. Now, that's a form that didn't necessarily exist in the same way in a print newspaper, but you have to do it in real time on the web because that's what readers want. They want information to analyze the news themselves.
Yeah, that's something that the Southern Bureau chief at NPR, Russell Lewis, has actually said before, is even if you're just writing a completely local story, it's on the web. Anyone can access it, so it needs to be written in a way that makes sense to someone who doesn't live in your town and doesn't know who these people are.
That's right, and you know, people want to see the universality in stories. I'll be speaking more about that today in my address, but you know, something that's small in Los Angeles, Chattanooga, can be big in other parts of the world. I'll give you an example. Several of our reporters worked on a story a couple of years ago on corruption in the city of Bell, which is a small city in southeast Los Angeles. The story involved a city manager who, when our reporters poked, you know, or probed, they found out that he went from making $72,000 a year to $1.5 million seven years later.
That's quite a raise.
Yes. Now, this was a small city in Los Angeles, but the story resonated with people around the world, so much so that, you know, we got calls and our reporters eventually traveled to Kiev in Ukraine to explain the story to people over there because they just got very interested in it. It won the Pulitzer for Public Service for the LA Times, which I'm very proud of, but it showed that a story in a small community at a time where Americans were suffering, the recession was on in full swing, people were tightening their belts, and this guy was making, you know, was laughing all the way to the bank. He pleaded guilty a couple of weeks ago, by the way, in Los Angeles. A story like that could resonate with outside of your community and, frankly, with the world.
You went to school here at UTC. Are there any particular lessons you remember from your professors, anything that still sticks with you today?
Yes, the lessons I remember, well, one, I was fortunate to have great professors, in communication, in political science, in history. And, you know, they challenged me to be my best, to do my best work. They challenged me also to become a better storyteller. And I think, frankly, because of my experience at UTC and the nurturing of my storytelling passion, I am who I am today.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was a conversation with Devon Maharaj. He's the editor of the Los Angeles Times Media Group, and he's a UTC alumnus. He visited the campus recently.
Funding comes from Sandy Maddox with Bellwether Investment Group, LLC, a local and independent investment advisory firm advising families and individuals from all walks of life. More information online at bellwetherinv.com.
And that's it for Rounded About Chattanooga. I am your host, Michael Edward Miller. Thank you all for listening. If you have questions, comments, or story ideas, you can email me, mike-miller@utc.edu.
Around and About Chattanooga is a production of WUTC with contributions by the staff and volunteers of WUTC. Find us online at wutc.org.